unlike so many people in every walk of life, this guy who had been told since he was 16 that he was God's gift and it was all meant to be and he was anointed and everything, this guy looked in the mirror and said to himself, I'm not good enough. I'm making mistakes. I'm messing this up. And he held himself accountable and he changed.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of the Basketball Strong Podcast. I'm Tim DeFrancesco, former LA Lakers strength and conditioning coach and doctor of physical therapy. And I'm here with my co-host, Emmy-nominated writer and author, Phil White. This podcast is not just for basketball junkies. It's for anyone who loves to hear the human stories behind great people while learning the science behind preparing your body for the court and high performance. Today's guest is Ian Thompson. Ian is the author of The Soul of Basketball. This is the book about the epic showdown between LeBron, Kobe, Doc, and Dirk that saved the NBA. Throughout his career, Ian has written for renowned publications such as Sports Illustrated, The Boston Globe, and NBA.com. You can follow Ian on Twitter at Ian Thompson. That's at IanThomsen. This is a special one for me because I've known Ian for a while, even before we worked in and around the NBA during the same time. I've had a chance to get to know Ian through his incredible writing, but I've also had a chance to get to know him as a person. As great as he is at telling story through written word, he is even more impressive as a person. In this episode, Ian takes us through his path of becoming a journalist and an author, and then he tells the story of one of the most pivotal chapters in NBA history, one that saved the NBA and created the soul of basketball. Let's get into the conversation. Ian, you and I go way back, and I want to give a little context before we dive in. I think it'll be helpful, but you and I actually first intersected when you came to see me for some neck treatment and neck problems at a PT clinic that I was working at right out of school. And I was telling Phil before the show started that I would extend how much manual treatment that you needed on the table so I could just get more and more stories from the basketball side of things with you. I don't know if you even realize that, but I don't know if that's against some of my clinical oaths, but we'll get into that later. But we go back that far, and then little did either of us know, as you were already well entrenched on the circuits as a veteran within the NBA ranks, I was meandering my way there, and we had a chance to circle up a couple times when the Lakers would come visit the Celtics as well. And you and I have enjoyed just a great friendship along the way. But the funny thing is, we're in those trenches, and within that time, we both obviously had so much going on. Sometimes there's not always a chance to really dive into some of the parts of our backgrounds. And really, as much as we did do that, there's always things that I've been curious about. And one of those things is, where was there an instance or a chapter within your childhood that you look back and say that helped to galvanize or begin the fusion of two passions for you, writing and basketball? And whereabouts did that kind of get triggered for you?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you, Tim, for saving my neck, literally. neck fusion surgery. And usually when I start telling stories, like, people start falling asleep. So help my rehab. That's like a unique outcome for me. So
I love it. Happy to help. And I'm always happy to listen to the next story of yours.
No, thank you. Thank you. And it's just a real pleasure to be on with you and with both of you. I really thank you for having me on.
So happy to have you.
Yeah. Thank you. As far as the question, honestly, I just got into this because I couldn't think of anything better to do, with like so many people. Like when you're in high school and you're applying for college and you don't know how to apply for college. I was the first one on either side of our family. Both my parents are immigrants from Europe. Basically the first one from either side to go to college. I had a cousin who'd gone 1 year before in Illinois. But we didn't know anything about how to apply to schools or what to major in or how to build a career in America, any of that stuff. And so I remember sitting with my mom, and she was going through all the different things I could try to major in. And she finally got the journalism. And I said, well, I've worked at the student paper. I I guess I won't say no to that, because I'd said no to everything else. Like, I just didn't want to, or didn't think I could do any of the other things she talked about. So, and then you go, I went to Northwestern University and went to the student paper to work basically full time while I was a student. And they asked me, the first person I walked in on at the student newspaper, the Daily Northwestern, was the managing editor, and it was Christine Brennan, who's been for decades one of the top sports writers in America.
Wow.
And Mike Wilbon was a senior on the sports staff there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So Chris asked me, what would you like to do here? And again, not being able to think of anything better, I said sports, because that was my great love,
Yeah.
And so it just, you just end up, what was your hobby or what you really enjoy doing, you end up doing for a living, just because I guess I liked it so much I couldn't think of anything else I wanted to do. At the same time, I backed into it. I didn't say I'm actively going to do this. It was because my mom made me answer the question. So
good work, mom. Good work, mom. So you said sports being one of your loves growing up, and was that playing mostly? Was that just being a fan of sports, and or both? What was that like?
I mean, I was playing. I mostly played soccer. I'm like, Tim, I'm 6'6".
Yeah.
I wasn't supposed to be that tall. No one in our family is that tall. My brother turned out to be almost as tall as me, but I was supposed to grow up to be like 5'11", 6 feet, something like that. So I played soccer, and then I just kept growing, So
yeah.
And by the end, the speedy forwards are just dribbling in between my legs just for the fun of it. but I wasn't very good, but I loved it. And I really loved following sports. And looking back on it, I think, as I was born in Montreal. My parents immigrated from Europe. They met in Montreal. I was born in Montreal. When I was six, we moved to Portland, Oregon. And so to fit in, I think I just gravitated towards sports. It was just a way to like connect with other kids and to have something to do, that was yours. So, collecting baseball cards and watching the games and talking about teams. And it was a way to try to fit in, even though I stunk at doing it. Like, I could talk to people about it. So that's what it was for me.
So at Northwestern, TD and I were joking, we love what you have in your bio on your website, that you had the dubious pleasure of covering what you said again on the website. It was at the time, the worst college football program in the country, or at least at that point. So can you talk to us a little bit about your brief on that? And then, how you really had to get used to another kind of football rather than the kind of football that you and I grew up with.
It's not a matter of opinion. They were the worst college football team in the history of college football.
Oh, in the history of the game. Okay. Well, I thought it was just a bad run for a while.
Well, it was a very bad run. And while I was there, they set the NCAA Division I record for losses in a row. I mean, I was moving into my dorm room as a freshman, and a kid down the hall said, "Hey, I'm going to the football game. You want to go?" And I said, "No, I'll go next week." Well, they end up, I think they beat Wyoming that first weekend I was there. So I went the next week and they lost, and I went the week after and they lost. And then I went after that and they kept losing. And all my sophomore year, they lost. And all my junior year, they lost. Finally won a game. And one of my best friends was the middle linebacker on the team. He led the Big Ten in tackles. And he was like the star of their first win. And they featured him at Sports Illustrated. His name's Rich Rappin. He ended up setting the Dallas Cowboys record for they used to do an intelligence test for draft picks. And he would have played in the NFL, but he tore up his knee, But anyways, so yeah, they were the worst team ever. And my junior year, I was the beat writer for the team for the student paper. And then my junior and senior years, Dennis Green was the head coach. They brought him in from Stanford to take over and turn things around, which he did.
Wow.
He couldn't do it his first year while I was covering the first year for the student paper, he went winless. But then the next year, I think they won three games, which was just a monumental achievement, truly. And by then I was working sort of full-time for the Chicago Sun-Times during my senior year of college, because one of their football writers, NFL writers, got mono, and he was in his 30s or 40s. And when you get it that late, it's debilitating. You can't do anything and it lasts forever. And so he was on the injured reserve list for months. And so they needed a body. So they asked me to sort of fill in. So that was really cool. My senior year, I was traveling all over the Midwest. They were flying me places to cover games. And I was covering all Northwestern's games for the Chicago Sun-Times, which at that time was one of the top 10 sports sections in the country. So it was really, I'm sorry that the guy Kevin had mono, but it was good for me though.
Yeah. It sounds like, though, that you did, you're being very humble about this, but you did develop some essential skills during your junior and particularly your senior year. So you're, you know, a journalism major. You mm-hmm. you mentioned an internship with the Boston Globe. You had a year this full-time gig with the Chicago Sun Tribune. So you must have learned not only how to write on deadline, but also how to juggle and time block things and just kind of learn on the fly how to cram all this in. What was that process like for you? And how did that serve you well when you went to the Globe as a full-time reporter out of college?
Yeah, you know, I'd heard all along, thank you. And I'd heard it all along that I was never, when I went to college for journalism, especially at Northwestern, it was supposed to be one of the top three journalism schools.
Yeah, I mean, that, maybe Missouri at Columbia, right? And then
those are the three, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's all I ever heard was. And so I'd always heard you're never going to get a job in that business. It's too hard to get a job and you have to work your way up and all that stuff. And it just scared me to death. And plus my Scottish mom told me many times while I was growing up that I needed to have a job. I was going to go to college and I needed to have a job when I got out of college. We would be driving, I'd be 12 years old. We'd be driving around somewhere like Oswego, Oregon. She'd say, oh, you know, so-and-so down the street, he's back home from college. I say, oh, that's nice. And she'd say, you know what he's doing now? And I'd say, no, what? She'd say, nothing. He's not doing anything. Can you imagine his parents go to all that trouble of sending him? I mean, you can hear the Scottish accent coming out.
Love it.
And all that money to send them off to college, the sacrifice they've gone through so he can go to college. And what does he do for them in return? Nothing.
He sits around having a wee dram or a wee pint.
Yeah. She doesn't have quite. That only came out though when she was talking with friends from Scotland.
Really?
This woman I did not recognize when she was around them, but she had like a North Americanized accent, but you would hear like little hints of it.
Oh my gosh.
Anyway, so between her telling me I better have a job and everyone telling me you're never going to get a job in journalism. So like right away, as soon as I went to college, like I was just going to do whatever I needed to do to pass, to get through academically. I was there to get a job and to make use
of one mission.
Yeah. And to make use of, you know, the Northwestern name, whatever it could do for me to help me. And it turned out what really helped me a lot, besides doing all the extra work I could, you know, working full time for the student paper and doing as many internships as I could, or if a team was by towards the end of my college, if a team was visiting the Chicago area, I would call their papers and ask, do you need somebody to cover the game? I can go do that for you. I mean, I was like a total go getter, just doing everything I could, and so. Between all that, I feel like I got a lot out of it. And then, you know, I hate to say this, but it was a real gift, like covering the worst team ever, because it sets you apart from everybody else. You know, that guy over there, he's only covering the third worst team.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it was something everybody wanted to talk about. They wanted to hear about it and they knew about
it.
Wow. Northwestern.
That's fascinating.
It was an infamous thing. And the year that they set the record, it was like the whole sports media world came to the campus for that weekend for that game. And I met everybody. I met all these big names from TV or print media, you know, and for like 1.5 minutes, they each wanted to talk to me because I was the beat writer. And so they talked to me until they realized I really didn't know anything. I wasn't going to help them. Talk to them for a little bit. And so all of that really helped.
Did that time kind of set the stage for some of your reporting on the story behind the story, or an unusual human interest piece that you became known for later on, you know? So whether it was, you know, with the kind of the Little League World Series age scandal, or some of those other pieces later on, or the piece that you won the National Sports Writer Award for with the kind of tragic story of the two high school playing football playing twins. Were there any during this time at Northwestern where a friend or maybe a colleague in that college newsroom told you about, oh, the other day, you won't believe what I heard, that was almost more about people than it was about sports? And did that in any way set the stage for what was to come later?
Oh, absolutely. And back then, you know, the business such as it is today, it's just so different. The priorities today are so different from what they were back then. And back then, you always had the sense that everybody wanted to be a writer. That's what they didn't want to be a sports writer, but a writer. You wanted to use sports to tell these kinds of stories. And when I got to the Globe, I really found that out. I mean, people would talk about it all the time, and it was, and that's what the Globe was known for, was that kind of storytelling. So yeah, you knew that you were going to have to, if you were going to make it in that business, you couldn't just say it was close but no cigar as the White Sox beat whoever. You know, you had to go deeper into it and use sports as a theater for the rest of the world. And that's how I've come to see it. You know, and especially in basketball, it's true. I feel like where the players are like actors on the stage, and they're playing out all these dramas of real life that we all live through. And you may be watching a game and it doesn't occur to you, but I think you relate to it in some way that maybe you don't even think about. But in basketball, you really get to know who players are. You can tell who they are as people more so than any other sport. And we can go into this a bit more if you want, but they have freedoms that other teams, team athletes don't have, freedoms of expression. And in fact, their success depends on their ability to express who they really are, rather than to, you know, subjugate it, rather than to suppress it. If you aren't being true to yourself as a player, you probably aren't going to make it. You have to find that channel. So anyway, so that was my point of view. Back then, I couldn't have put it into the words I just used, but that's what I was trying to get to. And that's what everybody was trying to get to. Today, there's still a lot of that. There's still a lot of people that try to do that. But today, there's such a premium now on news and being the first with either news or being the first with an opinion, a take. And the shorter, the punchier, the better.
Louder, the better, it's stated too. Because if we look at who's paid most, whether it's ESPN or even kind of like what TD and I have called like the Rush Limbaugh effect, and not that that's, you know, knocking anyone that's, you know, a fan of Rush or whatever, but he or she who shouts loudest seems to have the biggest platform now, and with socials as well. But TD and I were geeking out a little bit on this before you mentioned it. And TD, I'm jumping ahead a few years, so I'll let you rewind to the kind of Bob Ryan mentorship.
Yeah. But
so you mentioned actors on a stage, and in your book and on the website, when you're talking about the various actors in the soul of basketball. So you have the immigrant, as you put it, Dirk Nowitzki. You have the globalist in pop. You have the word I wouldn't say if my kids are listening, which they may be in the background, but the bastard, Kobe Bryant. And so
I'm sure he's very proud, though, by the way.
Yeah, I bet he
no
was.
Doubt.
I bet he was.
No doubt.
But you almost, TD said, you almost kind of like wrote it out like the front matter for a Broadway production. And that was such a great way to put it. So talk to us a little bit about that kind of actors on a stage model that you used for that book, and where that structure came from, and you know, how many years did it take you to develop that or build up to that?
You know, what really helped me a lot with this kind of trying to develop this point of view, and it was when I got to move to Europe. I worked for 6 years in Europe with the International Herald Tribune. What happened, the quick story, I went to the Boston Globe out of college, and I worked there through the 80s, from 83 until the end of 89. Frank DeFord started the National Sports Daily, which was ESPN before Al Gore invented the internet. Mm-hmm. It was like the first national sports newspaper, and it was printed in every city, and it was a colossal disaster. It like lost $125 million in 17 months, but they went around and hired all these. Yeah. Back then, that money back then, it was in our headquarters was the 666 building that Jared Kushner owns in Manhattan, the infamous building that, it's been a bloodsucker, I guess. But so when that went under, I was looking for a job, and the Herald Tribune newspaper in Paris hired me to come over and be their sports writer. They didn't have a sports writer, but they wanted to hire one. And so the editor of the Herald Tribune in Paris was this guy, John Vinokur, and he was a legendary journalist with the New York Times, who was now running the Herald Tribune, which was the world's largest newspaper. It circulated to every country on earth 6 days a week. And just one edition, one English language edition, but the same edition got sent everywhere. And it was half owned by the New York Times, half owned by the Washington Post. And so he wanted to have a sports writer. So he wrote to Frank DeFord, John Vinokur did, wrote to Frank DeFord and said, "You guys just went out of the business. Who among your guys should I try to hire?" And Frank gave him a list of six names, and I ended up getting the job, and it was just the best break for me of all. So I lived in Paris for 3 years and London for 3 years. But one of the big differences of living and working over there were just the conversations and the points of view that you were immersed in. People would, when you were talking to people about sports, they were talking about more than sports. And I think it's just because, you know, everything's a little bit homogenous here in the U.S. Everybody's American, no matter where you go. It's a huge country, but we're all Americans. But over there, you know, you travel the distance. It would take you from, Massachusetts to Pennsylvania. And over there, you could be in any of a half dozen different countries and different points of view. And they see everything in the context of their international struggles and wars and conflicts and alliances and histories that go way, way back. And that's how sports is seen. That's why national teams are so important over there, and winning these European tournaments just means everything.
Or in our case, losing them.
Especially in penalties.
I know. It's a sad story.
It is. It's like the Red Sox before they found religion. But so anyway, being around all of those conversations, it just kind of, after a while, even the most stubborn people like myself, after a while, you start to see it their way and start to develop that point of view. And so I started, when I moved back here, after 6 years over there, I moved back here to work for Sports Illustrated at the end of 97. And so that was sort of my take on things from that point forward, was seeing it less about stats, less about business, and more about people.
As Phil predicted, I'm going to bring us back a bit.
Here. Well done, TD. I took us into a time warp like 30 years or 20 years into the future.
Oh, it was beautiful. We're going to just kind of cast back here a little bit, though, because I want to have you talk us through a little bit, Ian, getting the, was it the internship with the Globe? It was initially an internship that you took there, and what landing that, was that something where, as you said, everybody wanted that job or to get into that vein and be able to work their way up through it. And was that something you applied for? And it was you had the chops, you had the experience, and in your journeys there in school, and that's how you rose to the top of that application list? Or was there a story behind that landing that internship?
It's an embarrassing story. So my junior year, I didn't go home for Thanksgiving, and I'm sitting on my bed watching a Notre Dame football game on a Friday after Thanksgiving. That's right. And I'm watching, and all of a sudden I realize the application for the Boston Globe internship is due that very day. If it's not postmarked that day,
what?
Apply for it. And I'm like, I'm not going to get it anyway. I won't bother. So what? You know, I've applied for everything else. I'm not going to get it. So I sat there watching the game, and, you know, it wasn't a good game. Like, Jerry Faust was the Notre Dame coach, so it was a bad game. None of his games were good. So I'm sitting there watching, and I start feeling guilty, and I'm not making this up. I'm literally thinking about my mother.
I was about to say you heard your mother's report.
I did. I truly. It's too good to be true, but I really did. I was like, you better go. You better go and apply for that. Who do you think you are now? So, like, I sat there, and they wanted a 500-word or 600-word essay to go with the application. And so I wrote about what it was like to cover the worst football team ever, you know, and how, like, they had this gimmick with to try to drum up fan interest. They had the mascot of the team was Willie the Wildcat, and they put him in a cage. And when we scored, they were going to let him out of the cage, and everybody was going to go crazy. Well, they put him in the cage. The first game, he didn't score. And the second game, they didn't score. And at halftime of the third game, they finally let him out, I guess, just for, like, you know, a pity or something. But nothing they tried worked. And so, and when I applied to the Globe, by that time I was thinking, you know, I've enjoyed doing sports, but I'd like to try to make a career maybe in news or writing features or something else. So you could list three priorities where you'd like your internship to be. And I listed news number one, features number two, sports number three. And I sent it in, but when you're writing about the worst football team ever, you know, you get noticed out of all the other essays. And so the guy, Ben Storia, called me up and offered me the internship. He said, look, I just want to make sure that, you know, you don't need to make a career out of this or anything, but I just want to make sure that you're going to be into it while you're here, that you really would want to do this. I just want 3 good months out of you during the internship, and then you can do whatever you want. And I said, no, I want this. I definitely want to do this. I was blown away that I was even being asked. So that's how I ended up getting out.
What a story. Good thing that was just a boring Notre Dame game.
Yeah, you know, if they'd fired him like they should have, like, everything might have been different for me.
Totally. So you get the internship, you're headed off to Boston, and you get there, and like you said, there's just this incredible murderer's row of people in that you're striving to become and be around, now get to be around. And you mentioned Jackie McMullen had also been the other intern, and you guys came in together. Bob Ryan is there, and these other just legends in your field. So how was a 1-year internship, or just a three, you said 3 months, and then
summer.
Okay. And then you immediately got a paid position there after that. Is that.
So I went back to Northwestern for my senior year, and that's when the Sun-Times thing opened up. So I quit the student paper and basically worked for the Sun-Times and was doing 2 to 4, 5 stories a week for them.
Got it.
You know, for each story. And so it was like, for me, it was a lot of cash in my pocket. So I was like eating at my favorite Chinese restaurant around the corner 4 nights a week.
Hey, right. And in college, it doesn't get any better than that, right? I
mean, no, it was like high living, high life.
And you had a chance to cover in the 80s, the Celtics, Lakers, those battles and be around those finals series, and take us into some of that. Take us into some of the things that stand out for you from those times for you.
Yeah. So at those big events, those like an NBA Finals or even playoff series, there'd be 3, 4, 5 writers covering that. So a lot of times they would have me cover the opposing team, maybe even early on in the playoff rounds, you know, first round, second round, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I was at 84 when the Celtics beat the Lakers. I was at game 7 at the Garden, Boston Garden.
Wow.
And then I was, I covered the entire series as one of several writers. I wasn't, Bob Ryan was writing all the leads, you know, and Lee Montville was writing the columns, and I was just doing sidebars or writing off day features or previews about the Lakers. So I was, and I was with the Lakers the other 2 years. I remember one year, the year the Celtics had their best team, it was the 86 playoffs. They were going to play the Bulls in the opening round. So the Globe sent me out to Chicago to do a story on Michael Jordan, who had been injured that year. He'd suffered a stress fracture in his foot and had forced his way back. They had wanted him to sit out, but he said, no, I want to play. And he convinced them to let him play. And he carried the team back into the playoffs. They, you know, they wanted to be in the lottery. The management wanted to be in the lottery, and he forced them in the playoffs. And so now he's going to play the Celtics in the first round. And that Celtics team was arguably the best team they've ever had, and maybe the best, one of the best teams in the history of the NBA. Bill Walton was their sixth man that year.
Right.
So I went out to Chicago, and they said, okay, Michael's in the trainer's room. You can go talk to him. And I ended up spending like 2 hours with him, just talking to him about stuff. And back then I didn't use a tape recorder. I was just taking notes by hand of everything. And so I did the story, and we had this guy, Larry Johnson, this amazing cartoonist. He worked full time for the Globe, and he would illustrate a lot of the stories we did. So instead of just using photos. So the Bulls, a few days later, the Bulls flew out to Chicago, and straight from the airport, they went to the Garden for a practice after they landed. So I was standing there. I was going to talk to them, you know, before or after the practice. And Jordan saw me standing, sitting on one of the courtside tables on the court at the old, on the old parquet. And the guy comes over and shakes my hand. He said, I read the story. I really liked it. Thank you. Which just never happens.
Wow.
And it was Michael Jordan. He said, you know, I didn't care so much for the cartoon, because the cartoon's like a caricature, you know. But I really like the story. So that was a cool thing for
that. Had to feel good.
However old I was, 14, 15 years old, whatever I was at that time.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Now is that the series coming back that he set the NBA playoff record for, was it 63 in the Boston Garden?
Yeah. So yeah, I think that was the second game. It was a Sunday afternoon game, and I was sitting, I had a courtside seat. We used to sit courtside back then. I mean, today it would go for $10,000 in the playoffs or something, but
sure.
I just remember watching him score that 63, and I'd never seen anything like the way he got off the ground so fast. It was like you were watching a video where the middle part of his jump had been edited out. It was like there was a snap of the fingers and he was on the floor and then instantly airborne. He just had something going that day. He was so fast, and there was nothing they could do to stop him. And that was when Larry Bird, after the game, said that was God disguised as Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
Was there a particular play? I know Larry tried to go out and cover him, and it almost like an Iverson-style crossover twice. Like, he shook him one way, shook him back, and then elevated to hit that jumper, which may be one of the most replayed highlights. But was there a particular play or moment when you thought, this is, you know, I'm witnessing history here?
Just repeated times. I was sitting more towards the Bulls bench that day, if I remember right. And when he would be driving to my basket, just repeatedly seeing him get off the ground like that and just be over the rim the way he did. It was really one of those times where you say to yourself, you really got to watch this, because you've never seen anything like it. And so you may not see anything like it again. And look back at that time, no one was thinking Michael Jordan's going to become the greatest player of all time. You know, there were a lot of really talented athletic players. Dominique Wilkins was an amazing guy. At that time, people thought Dominique and Michael, they were sort of the same thing, you know?
Wow.
And so, but to see him do that, it didn't mean he was going to become the greatest player ever, although you came away from it saying, wow, if this is how this guy plays, when he learns how to play the game, the NBA way, and they have players around him, because he was by far the best player on the floor, and Larry Bird was at the peak of his powers at that time, on that day. Then, you know, the other games, he scored a lot in the first game. It wasn't as close. And then the third game, he sort of ran out of gas. So how sustainable was it, you know? But it was an amazing thing that you just made sure you were going to remember it while you were watching it.
Incredible. Can you talk about, I mean, one of the things that was really neat in the story about how you had 2 hours to sit there with a notepad and pen or pencil and take notes with MJ sitting there, just, you know, opening up a bit, is a big difference from the availability and the access that media has to athletes today. But it seems like that was a little bit more normal then. Can you talk about some of the personalities on those great Celtics teams, especially that 86 team, and maybe some of the access points you had and some, any stories you had with any of those players of the home team?
Yeah. I mean, it was just understood that all of these leagues were in need of publicity. They needed as much attention as they could get, and they did not take it for granted. So there was just so much more. Peter Gammons told me that when he was covering the Red Sox, he basically spent all day at Fenway Park, and he'd go in and out of the clubhouse, and he would even shag fly balls in the outfield with them. Like, that's what he would do. I remember being with Michael that one time. I only had the one time with him, but he was telling me that, you know, he, as you know, Tim, he had that stress fracture in the spine, and worried that that might be the end of him. Those things can ruin careers. And Bill Walton had a similar thing.
Right.
And other guys, Yao Ming never recovered. He just kept hurting himself over and over again.
Yeah. Sam Bowie had some of those types of injuries, right?
And his legs. Yeah.
Yep.
So Michael asked if he could go home to North Carolina to rehab. He'd feel more comfortable there. It'd be better for him, better weather, all that. So they said, sure. So while he was down there, he told me in the interview, he was outdoors playing full court on cement, on asphalt, outdoors with friends to try to get himself back into shape.
Nice.
And if they had known that, they would have been, but, and today there's no way he could hide that, you know?
Right, right.
Yeah, some idiot would have been there with a smartphone, right? And would have put it online, fired it up on YouTube.
Jerry Krause and the Bulls, they had no idea. And Jerry Reinsdorf, they had no idea that he was doing this, that he was playing full court on outdoors with these guys. But he was telling me about it. And then when he wanted to play at the end of the year, they didn't want him to play. And so he finally got a meeting with Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner, and Jerry Krause, the GM. And he said, so I really thought about how I was going to do this, how I was going to go in and try to convince them to let me play. And so he said he got a pair of eyeglasses, but without lenses on them, because he didn't need lenses. He said, so I wore those in the meeting. And I said, why'd you do that? And he goes, because I wanted them to look at me differently. I wanted to present a different look. And I didn't want them to just be taking me for granted as a basketball player. I wanted them to see me as something more than that. And years later, like, all of a sudden, all these NBA players start wearing glasses just for the fashion of it.
Yeah, Durant and Westbrook, especially in OKC.
But he was doing it with a sense of purpose, you know?
Oh, yeah, or the, and that was like around the dorky school kid backpack phase with Durant and Westbrook as well. Like, yeah, a little sartorially questionable, but interesting, I suppose.
Yeah. It's not Urkel, right? But,
yeah, exactly. It was kind of the Urkel thing. Yeah. You said that you know, that 86 team is arguably one of the greatest ever. Was there a kind of story that, you know, again, a human interest story behind the story, or maybe if you got to talk to Walton about how he was physically diminished at that point, but obviously one of the greatest basketball brains of all time. Were there any kind of eras from that, you know, kind of 85 to 87 period that you look back now and think, man, that was such a blessing to even have been able to do a story like that?
Oh, no, just to be around them all the time and the characters on the team. And Tim, you were asked about this too. The characters on the team, just amazing. And it was just more relaxed back then, you know. Now you don't have, you can't be in the locker room. Well, especially during COVID, you can't. But
right,
it was just assumed that we were always going to be hanging out in the locker room, and it was all right. We were welcome. But Cedric Maxwell was the most colorful guy on the team, and he was always cracking jokes, and he's just so clever and funny, and always saying things. Robert Parrish was very much the chief, very quiet. Larry Bird was the man. Dennis Johnson, just think of all these names, all these Hall of Famers. Right. Danny Ainge was sort of like an outlier on the team, but very confident,
yeah.
Extremely confident. You know, we could cover practice all the time. We would say they practiced at Hellenic College out in the suburbs, and it was just this nothing gym, and it'd be empty except for the Celtics and the writers who were covering that practice, and you'd sit in the bleachers and just watch practice the whole time.
Incredible.
Which you're not allowed to do anymore, because I think they don't want you to see it in case there's a fight or something.
Right.
But yeah, just
Can you talk a little bit about Dennis Johnson, maybe even sort of let listeners who maybe didn't get a chance to really see Dennis play a lot and understand how good he really was, his play, his character and the character he was, but also his play a little bit, because I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Larry Bird called him the greatest teammate he had, or the best player he played with along the way.
Yeah, and Dennis Johnson had been MVP of the NBA Finals with Seattle at the end of the 70s, I think.
Man.
And then he'd gone on to the Phoenix Suns, and his reputation took a bit of a beating, so they were able to get him for relatively little to come to the Celtics in a trade. And, you know, there was a hierarchy built in, and yet there was a leadership role available for him. They had been playing sort of a two guard front, and he became more of a point guard for them. And he would guard Magic Johnson, even though he gave up quite a bit of size, but DJ was a great defender. Danny Ainge told me years later, and it's in my book, talking about this, that DJ had an up and down personality. There were some days that he had a lot of energy and some days he didn't have as much. And he'd be in great moods some days and not great moods others. He'd be up and down a bit. Larry Bird, I ran that by Larry Bird, and he said, no, that's not how I saw it at all. I didn't see it that way at all.
Wow.
So, there was just a lot going on in that team. And so many guys that really believed in themselves. When Bill Walton was there, they would just give him endless amounts of grief. I remember Larry Bird went over to Bill Walton's house one day. Bill was living in Cambridge, and Larry came back and told Bob Ryan, I'm never going over there again. That place is a madhouse. Kids have crayons and they're drawing on the walls of the house. So years later, Luke Walton is coaching, and I went up to him and I said, I remember Larry told Bob Ryan that he went over and that you and your brother were drawing pictures on the walls with crayons. He goes, yeah, that probably was happening at that time. Right,
it was right. it was like a Montessori school before that was a thing, right? was widespread, yeah.
And I grew up in Portland, Oregon, when Bill Walton was the star from the Trailblazers. Mm. And he lived actually a mile down the hill from me in Lake Oswego, Oregon.
No kidding.
And I always used to joke, yeah, when the wind was blowing the right way, you could tell when Bill was home because of the
lived organically. He lived organically.
Exactly. Yeah, he fit right
oh,
in.
Man.
Fit right
that's what was that's the, so cool.
It's really cool. What was the, because obviously now everyone talks about the storied rivalry and, you know, we have Byron Scott on, Coach Scott, and he said that, was it Cedric TD that was doing the color commentary for a while or something like that? And he refused to do it.
When he became a coach.
Yeah. So he just wouldn't do it until what, you know, I think the second year PR guy was like, man, please, they're giving me so much crap because you're the only coach that won't do this. And then he comes back in, the PR guy, to find that they're laughing and joking like old friends, you know, after they've broken that ice. But I mean, that mutual loathing was real, right? That was not just some media fictionalization.
Oh, no. And Pat Riley drove the whole thing, you know, and he paid attention to everything. The Globe sent me down to New Jersey once to meet the Lakers and to write a story about Michael Cooper, who was the guy that guarded Larry Bird all the time. Mm. And I just remember hearing the stories from Michael Cooper about how he was obsessed with Larry Bird, and his wife told me too. And he was always studying Larry Bird. And one year they had a little son, and there was some Larry Bird basket set for little kids, you know, like 4 feet higher or 6 feet higher, whatever. And they set it up in the backyard, and Michael couldn't help himself. He just kept dunking until he broke it. Like, he's the same. And they were watching, he and his wife were in bed and watching on TV that very season. And they saw the Celtics on TV. It was early in the season. And Larry had spent that summer getting in shape. For the first time ever in his life, he'd really focused on eating right and looking really good. And he was more sculpted than he'd ever been before. And Michael and his wife are watching, looking at him on TV, and they're both like, will you look at him? and they're like, look at him like, you know, like the Soviets had just come out with a new kind of nuclear warhead or something. It was going to have to be stopped. But yeah, it was a real thing. What I was doing in the book, I talked to Pat Riley for like 9 hours, and he was talking a lot about the Celtics-Lakers days when he was the coach. And I said, yeah, I was around all those things with the Globe. He goes, oh, I know. I'm like, how would you know? Like, I was like 23, but he was paying it. He wasn't lying. He was paying attention to everything. Like, he was on top of everything. He was really, and man, just all the charisma. I mean, one other thing I remember from being around those teams at that time, you know, for an early story, they told me to write about Bob McAdoo, who was coming off the bench, another future Hall of Famer, mm-hmm. who was coming off the bench for the Lakers, and he had played for the Celtics and had not gone well. So McAdoo said, yeah, I'll talk to you before the game. I said, where? He said, come in the locker room. So I go in the locker room, and it was this infamous, tiny visitor's locker room at the Boston Garden. And what they had, it was an L-shaped bench, and that was the whole seating for the team. And I go in, and the whole team's just sitting there quietly in the locker room. Kareem, Magic, Worthy, all these guys sitting shoulder to shoulder. And McAdoo sees me, and he goes, come on over like this. And so he makes room, and I squeeze in next to him. I can't remember who was sitting next to me on the other side. And we start doing the interview with each other, and everybody can hear every word you're saying. And so, like, we're whispering to each other. And even then, like, and I kept looking over, and there's Kareem looking, sitting in the room, just looking off in the distance. It was the weirdest thing ever to think before a Celtics Lakers game, you're in there like, it was just very,
bizarre.
Yeah, it was a really weird scene.
Is it true?
Happened today.
Is it true that they did used to either make that room super cold or super hot, or is that an exaggeration to make it uncomfortable, as well as it being too small and too cramped?
I mean, I'm sure it's an exaggeration. I'm sure it's true. And also,
well said.
The Celtics didn't control the building. That was the Bruins building. And the Celtics felt like second-class tenants in the building themselves. They never felt like they always got the leftovers from the Bruins, and they were always made to feel like they were renting space there. And so I don't know how much control they actually would have had over things like that, over, you know, the air conditioning and all of that, or if it was just sort of a European thing where at this time of year we keep it at this amount of degrees and there's nothing you can do about it.
Were there any other oddities or eccentricities, both as a team unit in that time, or just, you know, you mentioned DJ being a bit of a character and Walton being a bit of a character, any kind of behind the scenes things that aren't as well known or kind of outside of that broader narrative of the kind of bitter rivals, the arch nemesis?
Whenever the two teams were together, it was just a huge event and you could feel it. You know where I really felt it? I felt the history of it was in 2010. Yeah, so it's Kobe and Pau Gasol, and that's the Garnett, Pierce, Ray Allen, Rondo, Celtics. And being in the Staples Center before that game, you know, and knowing what, having been around the Celtics Lakers in the 80s, the pressure that you felt in that arena before the game, it really felt like an airplane kind of pressure. I mean, and everybody felt it. Even though it was internalized by you, everybody felt it. I remember talking to Joey Crawford, who refereed that game 7, and he said he felt it. Like it was an atmosphere he'd never experienced before. And he'd done all of the game 7s in the NBA finals. He'd done all of them, the previous 5 or 6 of them. So there's just something about the rivalry.
And that game 7, Ian, that was where Meta World Peace hit some of the threes down the stretch, and Kobe actually had a fairly tough shooting night, and the Pau had some key buckets down the stretch, and they pulled that out, right?
So yeah, I tell people it was the ugliest game I ever saw, and it was the greatest basketball game I ever saw.
Wow.
Because everybody was just, there was so much effort and angst and passion, and there was fear. All of it went in. They, both sides knew what was going on.
Yeah.
I mean, these two teams, you add up their totals, and at that time, they were responsible for close to half of all the championships that had been won in the NBA between those two teams. And the Lakers were steadily catching up on the Celtics' lead and were moving in on them. Kobe was playing for his legacy. I hate to use that cliche, but with him, it's really true. I mean, he had got blown out. He got blown out 2 years earlier in game 6 at Boston to lose the championship. And if he wants to be one of the greatest Lakers ever, he's got to beat the Celtics.
Yep.
He's got to do it. And so that game meant everything to him. He'd broken his finger, you know all about this, earlier in the season, Tim, and refused surgery. And so it changed the way he shot so that he could keep playing. He changed his shooting stroke.
Mid-season.
And still got them to the finals.
Right.
You know, and plus his knee was really bad that year. To see how Pau Gasol played in that game, he had 18 rebounds, 9 offensive. And when people say Pau Gasol soft, I just say you were not at that game.
Right.
I think he out-rebounded Kevin Garnett by 10 and just was all over the offensive boards and fighting for everything. And they would not have won without him. He, more than Meta World Peace, I think he was Ron Artest still at that time, more than him, Pau Gasol was the key of the game to me, all the extra possessions that he got the Lakers, and forcing the Celtics to keep playing defense over and over. So that was just a really a titanic game. It's the most important game in the history of the NBA. When you think about all that was riding on it, these two teams with all their history and they're fighting each other to be the winningest team ever. All the history that went in between them, all the history that went with Kobe, what was riding on it for him, is all the whole past of the NBA led up, funneled into that game.
Yeah. You mentioned this pivotal game seven, you know, and Powell kind of carries the load and carries them. And as you see, say, TD, Ron or Meta as well, hitting some key buckets. But I want you to rewind to something you touched on there a couple of years beforehand, where 20 years of hurt or so, after what we just talked about with Reggie Lewis and all the missed moves and almost could have been trades that didn't quite come off and everything in the middle. Can you talk a little bit about the Ubuntu team and, you know, the big three, Ray Allen, you know, Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett, and that how special that was to the city of Boston, and just kind of, again, your view of that from kind of the inside out.
Yeah, and they came along at such an important time for the NBA, because at that time there was a lot of fear for the NBA that the young players were ruining the league. They were
undoing the jailblazers thing and some of these other things.
But even more, this idea of wanting to follow Michael Jordan's example and having to be the man on your team. Mm. And that's what the whole Shaq-Kobe thing was about. Who was going to be the man? And that did not exist before Michael Jordan. I mean, it was always understood that you were, you know, great players didn't break up before Michael Jordan came along. But after that, the young guys coming into the league, they wanted to be Michael Jordan, and there was pressure on them to be Michael Jordan. The NBA thought, there was this thinking that the NBA couldn't survive unless they had a Michael Jordan figure. It was the one time that they'd been a sustainable operation as a league, where they were actually profitable and ascendant. And it was because they had this one Superman that carried everything. It all went through him. And so who's going to be the next Michael Jordan? That was the constant question that was being asked of the NBA.
Is it going to be Grant Hill? Is it going to be Kobe? Is it going to be, And I mean, the media fed into that, right, with some of the covers, and almost culminating a couple of years later with LeBron on the cover at, 14, 15? Like this anointing of a teenager.
Exactly. It was all this pressure on them that, and it was undoing what basketball is really about. It's about the opposite of that. It's about, you know, you need the great player, but you need everything else too. And he needs to exist within his community and he needs to empower others. It can't be a supporting cast. It has to be, it has to be where everybody's working together and you're helping him and he's helping you. But that was in danger of being undone. These young players were under this pressure to live up to this example that had been set. And so Shaq and Kobe break up. And players want to have their own team. That's what a young player comes into the NBA believing is what is wanted of him. It's not even really selfishness. It's more like trying to live up to a standard and doing what's asked of you. That's where the NBA was. All these guys who were coming in before they knew how to play NBA basketball were empowered, entitled to be more than they really were, to pretend to be like they had all the answers when they didn't even know what the questions were. So now you have these three Celtics come together all of a sudden, and Pierce was 29, I think, when they came together, and Garnett's 30, Ray Allen's 31. But they'd all been the leader of their own team and they'd all been stars. Garnett had been a league MVP and none of them had done anything team-wise. None of them had ever been to an NBA finals, not really even come close. And they'd all had it their way and it hadn't worked. And it was almost like a cautionary tale for all the young players out there. They knew where it was going and they knew it was a dead end. And so they get together on that Celtics team and they agree, we're going to not worry about numbers. We're not going to worry about stats or shots. We're just going to play together and we're going to see what we can do as a team. And they changed the whole mold. Like within 1 year, all of a sudden, everybody wanted to be like the Celtics. Man. And so when LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh get together in Miami, and everybody was so angry with them for doing that, I was like, are you crazy? This is the best thing that could have happened, because LeBron's not going somewhere because he wants to have his own team. And so he can have the ball all to himself and he can have all the spotlight. No, he wants to share it. He wants to create a team. He doesn't want to use his teammates. He wants to invest in his teammates. You know, he doesn't want to exploit the game. He wants to make the game bigger. And that was a huge thing for the NBA. And it was all because those three guys showed there was so much more reward in playing team basketball with great players than there was in like doing the Shaq and Kobe thing and divorcing because of it.
Yeah. How crucial was Doc's leadership there and his example?
Well, he saw it, and I think they would not have gone along with it if they hadn't seen it themselves. But he was the orchestrator of it, the conductor of it, and he talked about it all the time. And, you know, it's a famous thing, like in the preseason, they met in front of Doc's hotel, the three stars did. And they're standing, so Doc's standing out on the sidewalk downtown Boston. I think it's outside it's on Huntington Avenue. I can't remember the name of the hotel. And all of a sudden, one of the duck boats pulls up, just an empty duck boat pulls up. And Doc says to them, get in. They're like, what are we doing? And he says, we're going to do the parade. I'm going to show you the parade route. When we win the championship at the end of the season, this is the parade route we're going to go on, and I want you to see what we're going to be doing. And so these three guys who have the power to create that parade, they're sitting on the bus, and the guy's like showing them the different sites. And the whole time Doc's talking to them about, okay, so how do we get this parade? How do we do this? You three guys, it starts with you three guys. And you can't be worried about how many shots you get. You can't be worried about this or that. You have to be playing team basketball. You have to do it for each other. You tried it your own way and it didn't work. And now you can't do it the way you think it ought to be. You got to do it the way we think it ought to be. And so that whole thing came to be. They did end up winning the championship that year, and they were back on the duck boats all those months later. But it's because they thought about it. They were very conscious of who they were and what they were going up against. They were going up against a league that sort of forsaken all those values, and they brought them back up. And those are the original Celtics values. The Celtics were the team that identified and articulated all that in the first place when their best player, Bill Russell, was never their leading scorer, but he was their best player on defense, and they ran their offense through him, and they ran the fast break, and he established this idea that to be a great player in that league, that sport, you have to lead your team to championships. And if you don't lead your team to championships, you're not a great player. The whole Wilt Chamberlain or Bill Russell argument, the yin and yang of that. Mm. And Bill Russell was the one that took the NBA away from being a selfish model into a team model.
Getting into the soul of basketball a little bit further, I just found it so fascinating the way you, as we talked about, you have this cast of characters. And in a second, I want to get to how you would describe the character of Pat Riley and maybe the man behind the curtain type of character as I saw him in reading the book. But a dynamic that was really, really interesting, one that I hadn't really looked at this way, was the idea of Kobe, MJ, LeBron, what was maybe supposed to happen in take the person of Kobe initially being touted as who's going to take the torch directly or take the crown directly from MJ, and then actually what happened in that. Can you open that up a little bit?
Yeah. So Kobe comes in, and by his second year, everyone's saying, this is the next Michael. We found the promised land, and Kobe's there, you know. In fact, when I moved back from Europe to work for Sports Illustrated, the first assignment I got at Sports Illustrated, they said, there's this guy in the second year with the Lakers, and he looks like he's going to be a great player, and we'd like you to go out and do a story with him, Kobe Bryant. So I flew out to L.A., and he picked me up at my hotel in Santa Monica, and we drove to some—
Kobe did. Kobe picked you up.
Yeah, and he had an Escalade. And, we drove— he drove me over to this outdoor restaurant. Because, look, he was 18 years old at that time.
Sure.
I think. So this was a big deal for him, Sports Illustrated.
Right.
Back then, and back then, Sports Illustrated meant a lot. And this was going to be his first big feature there. So we went to some outdoor restaurant kind of bar kind of place. Had all these couches kind of lined up, very long couches. And we sat out for 4 hours and just talked about everything. Again, no tape recorder. I'm just writing everything down. It's— get really tired after 4 hours of writing like that.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And so a young woman was sitting next to Kobe. And after a couple hours, she says to him, hey, do you mind me asking, do you play for the Lakers? And he said, yeah, I do. And she said, what's your name? And he said, Kobe Bryant. Oh, okay. Nice to meet you. My name is blah, blah, blah. So like, he's still not like a household name.
He was below the radar. Yeah.
Yeah. As much as he could be at that time.
Right. Right.
So that— a lot of that was the story. And that was the year he went— he wasn't starting for the Lakers, but he started in the All-Star game because
they
saw him as the next Michael. And so that was Michael's last All-Star game with the Bulls. It was at Madison Square Garden in New York. And it was Kobe versus Michael. And that was the mark— that was the setup. That was how it was being marketed, that game. And so that's what Kobe was up against. And he wanted it. You know, he wanted to be the next Michael.
Yep.
He studied Michael Jordan, everything about him. When Kobe was growing up in Italy, because his father, Joe Jellybean Bryant, was a player in the Italian league after leaving the NBA. Joe Bryant would have videotapes back in the VHS era sent over. And Joe Bryant's favorite team was the Lakers and Magic Johnson. But he'd have all these videotapes sent over from a scouting service and also from his parents. And he and Kobe would sit and watch the games and study. And Joe would teach Kobe the moves. And then Kobe would go out into their backyard, the basket they had, and practice all these moves. And he was doing that from a young age. And I always wonder if part of that was why he was such an individualist as a player, because he grew up in a setting where he was on his own lot practicing by himself.
Yep.
It became very much an individualist sport for him. But so he studied Michael Jordan. He had the same mannerisms as him. He'd flick his baton the way he did, look away at certain times the way Michael— even sound— if you shut your eyes, even sounded like Michael at times. And everybody saw that, everybody knew about it, and Kobe was not ashamed of it. I mean, he just wanted to be Michael. But then he got into all that trouble. And he was not popular, especially in his early years with his teammates. When it was Shaq and Kobe, Shaq was the personable one. He was authentic. Shaq knew who he was. Kobe didn't know who he was as a young guy. He was trying to be somebody he wasn't. He didn't have it figured out yet. And his teammates saw through that. And so they didn't like him as much as they liked Shaq. And so there were all these squabbles in the team, and Kobe was very often the bad guy in those. And then there was his legal trouble. He was accused of rape in Colorado. And when that happened, that was it. He was never going to be the next Michael Jordan. Even though the case was dropped and he was never found guilty or anything, that was it. He was done. And I think he sort of figured out, okay, I'm not going to be that. I'm going to be who I am. I'm going to figure out who I am. If I'm coarse, if I'm rough, if I'm not what people like, so be it. I'm just going to pursue my own aims. So he became the bastard, as he's referred to in my book.
Yeah.
And he embraced that. And then LeBron comes along a few years later, and he's now seen as the chosen one. That was, I think, the name on the cover of the Sports Illustrated that he was on when he was a junior in college. And I'd heard about him when he was a sophomore, no, when he was a junior. An NBA source of mine said, you know, if this kid had been, if he'd come out as a sophomore, we would have picked him number one overall in the draft, sophomore in high school. He's that good. He's Magic and Michael put together. That's what the guy told me. So I called the editors at Sports Illustrated and said, the next great player is this guy, LeBron James. And so a few months later, we put him on the cover. And that sort of defined him. And that was the worst thing that could have happened to him. I mean, it was the best thing as far as his name recognition and all the money he was going to make. But it set up this impossible standard. And it was an anointing. You know, all of the other great players in the league, including Kobe, they've come in and sort of had low expectations compared to what they became. And they were allowed to climb to their own level. And LeBron was the only guy that came in. And the people said, before he even come close to having any kind of training for it, they said, you're going to be the best player in the league and maybe the best ever, or at least compete with Michael for that. But he had no college basketball in him. He had nothing to back it up.
Right.
So he really was up against it that way. And then his teams in Cleveland, he did not have talent around him. And that's how Pat Riley was able to recruit him, by telling him, look, no great player in this league has ever done anything without having great teammates around them. And if you come here, you'll have that. You've never had it in Cleveland. So that was the pressure those two guys were under to try to live up to Michael. And it really set them both back. Ultimately, it brought out the best in them, but it made their early years really, really difficult, much more difficult than it had to be.
So fascinating. And then, as you just brought up, Pat Riley is this man behind the curtain, and he's orchestrating things. You spent 9 hours, as you said. Can you give us some insight into Pat and what you took away from some of that, and without giving too much of the book up, because people, you've got to read this, just how this all plays out. And as you said, say what these characters did to save basketball.
Yeah. No, he had his eye on LeBron, you know, for years beforehand, and started saving up, planning the salary cap space a couple of years before he actually recruited LeBron. He had coached Magic Johnson in the 80s, and they won those championships. And then he had Shaq with Dwayne Wade for a year. They came back from 2 down against Dallas and won the championship. But he had never had that great player in his prime since Magic. And he wanted that again. And he knew how powerful that would be, especially with all of the institutional knowledge that he now had, that he could pass on to that, to whichever player that was, to try to get the best out of them. You know, when he had Magic, Pat Riley was still learning to be a coach himself. But now he was a former Hall of Fame coach, an executive. He knew everything about winning, and he was just waiting to share it with somebody. And that was how he drew LeBron to him, because LeBron really needed that. When you think about all the other great players, for the most part, they all have that mentor coach. They have that partnership, that relationship. And LeBron never had that. And so Pat Riley is the closest thing to that LeBron's ever had. And so, yeah, he brought him in. They would practice. And in his first year, LeBron was much heavier than he is now. He wasn't fat.
Yeah.
It was all muscle. It was strength.
Right. Carried,
yeah, he was like 260, 270. And yet exploding and getting around guys and moving laterally. But Pat Riley said, you know, you should think about losing 20 pounds, he said to LeBron. And he had him wear a vest, a weighted vest of 20 pounds, just to show him how much extra weight he was carrying. So he wore that in practice, and he said, okay, now when you're exhausted, take it off and feel the difference losing that weight. And now imagine not having that weight over a full season and how much better you'll be by the end of the year. And so he did. He followed that, and he lost a lot of the weight, especially in his upper body, but he kept it. He kept in his butt and his legs so he could have that strength.
Right.
Able to maneuver defenders, but to still be able to explode and everything. When they lost in the finals to Dallas, and LeBron just kind of collapsed in that series and played very, very badly. It's the worst he's ever played in his life. And he took the blame for it. And he was already America's villain for the way he'd left Cleveland to go to Miami. And now everyone was laughing. Everybody would just love the fact that he lost. And Riley told me that LeBron came into the office and was just kind of storming around. And he could see that LeBron was going to go back home and was just going to be depressed and angry and just couldn't be helped for a couple weeks. And then Riley was wondering what was going to happen after that. That was going to be the key thing. And what happened after that was, unlike so many people in every walk of life, this guy who had been told since he was 16 that he was God's gift and it was all meant to be and he was anointed and everything, this guy looked in the mirror and said to himself, I'm not good enough. I'm making mistakes. I'm messing this up. And he held himself accountable and he changed. He changed a lot of things. And he, first of all, basketball wise, he'd always refused to post up. Well, he went and spent time with Hakeem Olajuwon and committed to learning to be a post-up player and started doing that in the playoffs. That was one thing. But the basketball things were easy. He thought about how he could be a leader and how he probably deferred too much to Dwayne Wade in the first part of the year. When I talked to Larry Bird about LeBron's first year in Miami, he said this: he's thinking too much. He's just not going for it. He's not reacting. He said, at this level, you can't be thinking. You just have to go for it. And if you see it, you go for it. You can't be wondering if Dwayne Wade's going for it. You just have to do it. And so he started doing that again. And he became more of a teammate, more of a leader. He started studying the scouting report. Doc Rivers told me that all of a sudden he noticed that LeBron was calling out the Celtics plays, something he'd never done before. He said, this guy's into the scouting report. Bad sign for the Celtics or all of his opponents. So he became that complete player. And you could tell he was really listening to everything Riley was saying. Maybe he wasn't doing all of it, you know, but he was really paying attention. He was making the most of their time together.
Yeah.
And he has since said that the 4 years he spent in Miami were equivalent to his 4 years of college. It was his education that helped him to become not only the player he is, but he says the person he is now. That's and let amazing. Me say also, LeBron never talked to me for this. This is all just things I've read from him or heard from him in the past. I'm not pretending to be a LeBron whisperer or anything.
Sure.
But talking to all these people around him and then hearing how he's responded to it, you can see what the story is.
Oh, I love that.
No question.
Well, Ian, you shared so much with us today. We want to be respectful of your time. But before TD asks you the last question that we ask everyone or that he asks everyone on here, can you just share a little bit about how Dirk Nowitzki fit into this cast of characters in your book?
So if LeBron was a natural that everybody thought from an early age was going to be the great player, Dirk was the opposite. He taught himself to be a shooter. He and this guy, Holger Geschwindner, who was a great German player in the German leagues, you know, the semi-pro leagues, they got together and figured out how Dirk could be the best player he could be. And Dirk was a guy that played tennis growing up and was very athletic and everything, very tall, very long. But how do you teach a guy to try in that environment at that time, teach a guy to be good enough so that he transcends German basketball and can play in the NBA? That was the goal. And so Holger went through and figured out a way for this guy to shoot. Holger said, I went through and looked at the histories of other great players in the NBA and realized I could take nothing away from that. Those were their histories. That worked for them. The way they played, the way they reacted, the way they shot, that worked for them, but that wasn't going to work for Dirk. So they had to build everything from scratch. And Holger showed it to me years later. When the technology finally came around to support it, he was able to show me a computer program that he'd built of a stick figure shooting a basketball, and it's the perfect stroke. And you can see the energy starts in the feet and it builds up through the legs. And as you go up, and the release of the ball from the fingertips is just sort of like a wave forming in the sea. And then it breaks as it hits the beach. It's just the energy that came up from the feet up through the body. And he taught Dirk to shoot in a certain way. And they worried about things like the angle of the shot, the trajectory, and when should he be breathing during the shooting stroke. And
wow.
And it wasn't only that he had to be able to have a perfect stroke. It had to be able to withstand all kinds of conditions. So I went over to Germany 1 year early in his career, and I watched them during one of their workouts. It was like an hour, 20 minutes, hour and a half. It's in an empty gym in Germany. And Dirk would just shoot the whole time, but Holger would be shoving him while he shot, or Dirk would have to like do a push-up and stand up and shoot. Or
yeah, that lunge position you saw, right? That the world's longest lunge with those big long legs.
And all these different things he had to do. And then also, because at that time the plan was for him to gain muscle, Holger had him wear a 20-pound vest, but it was to build up the muscles. So
different reason.
So that when he gained the weight, his body wouldn't be surprised and his knees wouldn't give out, his hips wouldn't give out. They would be strong enough to support the weight that he was going to gain as he got older. So this was really thought out. It was like going to a dance school and you know how they have the footsteps on the floor and you're supposed to follow.
Yeah.
That's how Dirk Nowitzki learned how to play basketball. Everything was self-taught. He was not a natural by any means. Everything you saw him do was invented. And so he and LeBron came at it from opposite ends of the earth. And LeBron was a guy that was told all the time, you're going to be great. You're going to win championships, expect it. And it hadn't happened. And Dirk was a guy, he said, I can't do this. I wonder if I'm good enough. I shouldn't be the leader of the team. He would spend all this time before games warming up, trying to find the right rhythm to try to carry him into the game somehow. He was so worried all the time. He just didn't think he was capable.
Yeah.
And so when a guy like that wins the championship, it really puts everything in perspective. And I really think in a way, I don't know how much this mattered to LeBron, but it really put LeBron's whole story into perspective. That this guy who really had no expectations, it had never happened before that a guy from a foreign country with no college basketball experience comes in as an American rookie and is able to lead a team to a championship. And, you know, Hakeem Olajuwon had led the team to a championship, but he'd been Americanized by Phi Slam Majama.
Sure.
Dirk came in not having any background and led the team to the championship.
And so without his best friend and running mate, Steve Nash as well, who had gone to Phoenix.
And he didn't think that he should be the leader of the team. He wanted Steve to be the leader of the team. He wanted Michael Finley to be the leader of the team. And finally they were gone and Dirk had to do it, but he didn't feel comfortable doing it. And he had a lot of losses in the playoffs on the way going in. And so for a guy like that to win the championship, it showed, it just cast into great relief where LeBron was.
Yeah, I'm so glad you
most of all his talent. And it really, he made the most of it ever since. He went to 9 straight finals, I think. After
Right. I'm so glad, Ian, that you brought that up about the sort of transformation mindset wise and leadership wise that Dirk had to go through of his natural instinct to come in and be the second, third fiddle and kind of sit back a little bit and glad to be there kind of guy and that kind of thing. Because, you know, Steve Nash has talked about it and I've heard him talk about it that we forget that he had to learn that. He had to force himself into that. Give me the ball when it's crunch time, I'll take care of it, which we saw in those moments and towards the parts of his career that we all remember the most, which as he was just pouring in buckets on buckets on buckets. But he wasn't that way out of the gates. And Steve talks about it as the two of them sitting in the locker room and Dirk saying, what are we doing here? I'm not going to be able to make it. We're not a couple of white guys sitting here. We're not going to be able to do this for very long. And Steve saying, no, man, you can't think that way. And having to really try to pull that out of him, which, as you said, once those guys were gone and Finley was gone and Steve wasn't sitting next to him saying, no, we got this. He had to get that himself. And it's so just such a cool transformation that he and powerful transformation that he went through that people maybe, I'm sure many people don't realize, and unless you talk to somebody like Steve or yourself and read this book and watch it unfold in this story. It's so, so powerful. So Ian, this has just been incredible, and I know Phil and I could keep going, but I want to get you back to your family and thank you so much for taking this much time, but we do have one signature question that we finish off with, and this is the Basketball Strong podcast. So the question is, and you can answer this spiritually, technically, from your heart and your gut and your mind, whatever comes to it. But the question is, what does it mean to you to be basketball strong?
It's a great question. You know, to me, basketball is, let me back into it. So basketball was invented 1891, I think. And this is the same time that jazz is being invented in New Orleans. And Thomas Edison is coming up with all his inventions. And the car is going to, is coming to be, and it's going to change everything. And it's just this time of incredible American invention. And it's the one sport that is really popular in our country that we did not bring over from the old world. It's not, baseball comes from cricket and a sport called rounders, and American football comes from rugby and soccer. And those sports have different rules for different players, depending on who you are. They're old world, right? You're born into who you are. Your fate is decided already. So if you're an offensive lineman in football, there's no chance you can be the star. You're not even going to get to touch the ball. That's the rule. But the quarterback can do everything. The quarterback is a Superman because the rules say so. The rules say he can do this, but you can't in football. Baseball, I'm the best player. Why can't I hit? Well, it's not your turn. You have to wait your turn. You're the number three hitter, and right now the number seven guy's up. So, but why does the pitcher get to do all he does and I have to wait in the outfield? Everybody's got their own rules, and your pawn's on the chessboard, and you just have to take what you are. And there's only so much you can do, and there's limitations, fate. And in basketball, you make your own fate. If you go through the rule book of basketball, there's no mention of center, forward, or guard. There's only players. Everybody's the same. It's the only sport in this country among the big three and hockey too, where the same rules apply to everybody. We're all equal. So it's the American sport. It really is. Now those are the ideals of it. Does it live up to it? No. the United States of America live up to its ideals? No. But that's the idea of it. That's the ideal of it. This idea of equality. And that to me is why the great player has so much more influence in basketball than the great player in some other sport. Why the number one pick is so much more valuable in basketball than it is another sport, because LeBron or Kobe or whoever it is, he can influence the game at both ends. He can go and get the ball anytime he wants. It's up to him. And so when I watch a basketball game, I just feel like I'm watching the American experiment come to life. In a way, especially the way the NBA has become now, it really is a melting pot league. Players from every corner of the world, and you can see who they are. You can see the color of their skin. When they speak, you can hear the accent. Now with social media, you can tell what they believe, what their beliefs are. they bring their past with them here. And the role of immigration in the NBA has really saved the NBA. It's all these foreign players who came along a time when the NBA was very cynical and was being accused of being selfish. Well, these immigrants, they weren't cynical. They believed in the ideals of basketball and the Dirk Nowitzkis and all these guys. They came in and they did for the NBA what immigrants do for a country. They add fresh blood cells to the bloodstream of the United States, and they have dreams, and they aren't cynical. They believe in the whole thing. So when I see all of this happening in the NBA, I just see how it mirrors what's wrong with our country and what's right with our country and what could be with our country. And this whole idea of the American experiment and how the framers of the Constitution came up with a different idea than anybody else ever had before. And the ideals of it, even though everybody's falls short, the ideals of it, that's what I see basketball players when they want to be strong. They're reaching for that ideal. They're reaching for that higher calling. And they know that it's not enough for me to do well. I have to do so well that everybody around me does well too. And I'm not just committed to myself. I'm committed to others, and they're committed to me. That's what our dream is. Are we going to get there? Maybe not, probably not, but that's what we're trying to do. And that's the strength. That's the integrity of it that I think makes it really important, more important than the sport. If you think about what it stands for, it's more than just scoring more points than the other team. It's actually exemplifying a way to live so that you feel like you're really getting something out of your life.
That might be the best question we've heard, best answer to that question we'll ever hear, TD.
That was, listeners are not going to believe that I did not lob the question over ahead of time, and they're not going to believe that was not scripted. That was absolutely beautiful, Ian. My gosh, I can't wait to rewind that one and go through it again. Thank you so much. That was absolutely I'm a little bit at a loss for words. Thank you. That was just incredible. Take a second, Ian, please. And just the book is The Soul of Basketball, the epic showdown between LeBron, Kobe, Doc, and Dirk, and how they saved the game. Where can people get their hands on that book? Where can people follow you? And don't leave out the word of Eugene, please.
Oh, thank you. The Soul of Basketball is available online everywhere. I appreciate that very much, Tim. It took me years to write the book. In a lot of ways, I had to wait until LeBron had played it out to show that there was more to him than the villain that people saw when he first went to Miami, that there was a redeeming quality to the story. So, yeah, I appreciate
so good
that there's still some relevance to it. You know, I always wanted it to be a timeless story.
Oh.
And I'm just starting. It's not quite there yet, but I am starting a newsletter on Substack called Word of Eugene, and it's going to have a different point of view to it.
For sure, I've had a sneak peek, and it's so good.
Well, I appreciate it, but some of the things we've been talking about today, but hopefully in a funny way.
Yeah, for sure.
So, but
for sure. And people can follow you on Twitter.
Eddie and Thompson, my name, no P in
it. Yep. Thomsen.
Yeah. But thanks very much, guys, for having me. It's been a real pleasure. I've loved speaking with you. And Tim, it's amazing to me. I'm not amazed, actually. I'm not surprised at all. But the two guys could meet in Swampscott, Massachusetts, someplace across the street from the local high school, and then a few years later, be talking out on the court of TD Garden. Or
that's stadium. Right.
They even named the arena after you, Tim. It's pretty impressive.
so special. So special. Well, it's a friendship that was bonded long ago, and we'll continue on. I'm grateful for it, and grateful for your time today, and just being able to have you as a friend and a resource, and much more to come from that. But thank you so much, Ian. This has been great.
Thank you both, guys. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed today's show, and we hope you did, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you listen to podcasts on. And so you never miss a weekly episode, be sure to subscribe and follow. You can find previous episodes on our show website. That's www.basketballstrongpodcast.com. For more basketball performance resources and nagging injury solutions, follow me on Instagram at TD Athletes Edge, and follow Phil at Phil White Books. Until next week's episode, stay basketball strong.